Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Seth Meyers here. Welcome to this February edition of Late Night Lit, our podcast series that celebrates books and authors we love here at Late Night. I'm going to turn things over to our own Sarah Jenks Daily, your host of Late Night Lit. Take it away, Sarah.
Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Jenks Daily and welcome to Late Night Lit. This month, we are thrilled to speak with Gail Zemach Lemon, a New York Times bestselling author whose latest book, The Daughters of Kobani, is an impressive narrative based on hundreds of hours of interviews and years of on-the-ground research in northeastern Syria. It not only explains the conflict in the region and the history behind it, but it also offers an unprecedented look into the lives of the all-female militia who fought against ISIS. We also talk with National Book Award finalist and novelist Brandon Hobson, author of the fantastic new book, The Removed, which tells the story of a Cherokee family grappling with loss, ancestral trauma, and their unbreakable connections to the spiritual world and each other. And finally, some late-night staffers will share a few of their own Goodreads. Gail Zemach Lemon is a New York Times best-selling author, journalist, and public speaker. But first and foremost, and in her own words, she's a storyteller. Her latest book, The Daughters of Kobani, tells a true and almost unbelievable story of an all-female militia which took on ISIS. Combining years of research, hours of interviews, and reporting from the ground in northeastern Syria, she brings the stories of these heroic women into the light. Now here's my chat with Gail. Gail, hi, and welcome to Late Night Lit. Thank you for being here with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
I'd love if you could start with a little background. You are at your core, I think you might describe yourself as a journalist. I know you got your start in D.C. and then moved into covering conflict in different parts of the world. So can you tell us a little bit about your trajectory?
So I would say above all else, I'm a storyteller, and I have the privilege of shining a light on places and people and things I think are making a difference and matter. And this book was really the product. My first book was about a teenage girl whose business supported her family under the Taliban, the dressmaker of Karkanat. The second book grew from that, Ashley's War, which was about an all-women special operations team recruited for Army Ranger and Navy SEAL missions. And then one of the young women who was part of Ashley's War called me and said, "You have to come to Syria. You have to see what's happening here." And that is what led to this third book, which is The Daughters of Kobani. And I truly believe that I never set out to tell stories about women. I set out to tell stories that matter and stories that had impact and that made me see the world differently and that inspired me to work to help others to see the world through the eyes of the people who trusted me with their story.
Absolutely. I was going to ask my next question, actually, which you sort of already answered, was this incredible story began with a tip from your friend. And you go into that at the beginning of this book. Can you tell us just a little bit more in detail about that?
Sure. So the introduction to Daughters of Kobani is about me wrestling with whether I would do justice to the story. So one of the young women who was part of an Army Special Operations team called me and said, "You have to come to Syria because you have to see what's going on here. We're working with these women who are fighting ISIS." And at that point, the fight was still very much underway. And she said, "It's absolutely unlike anything we've seen. These women are 100% intent on not just fighting ISIS and stopping ISIS, but on bringing equality to their corner of the world. And you've got to come see it, truly.
In the book, there are a few photos, and one in particular where you're seated and speaking to some women, and you obviously spent hours interviewing people. I wonder, just first off, looking at that picture, what was the communication like for you? Did you always have a translator with you? Were there ever things that were lost in translation that had to be clarified? Like, how did that work for you?
It's such a great question. And, you know, so I set out to tell the story of, answer the question of how did this come to be, that we're seeing this, you know, most far-reaching experiment in women's equality in almost the last place most people would expect to see it, brought to you by gals who've been fighting ISIS room by room and house by house. And I think, okay, so how do you set out to tell that? And part of my hesitancy at the beginning was I understood how, you know, that takes over your life and you really have to toil to get the small things right because it will matter so much to all of you at home. And to do that, you have to have the right team. You have to have the people who not only you trust, but who you know you won't be putting in danger because they know how to take the risks and they know how to be smart about mitigating the risks of navigating telling the story, but also that you're, the people who are trusting you will trust because these folks are what are called fixers in the parlance of storytelling, but they're really journalists who help you set up your interviews. They translate your interviews. They make sure that you talk to all the people who are relevant to the story. They work with you to navigate, okay, if we go to this town, how many interviews can we get done? And then we have to drive 7 hours because, you know, the logistics of telling a story in northeastern Syria are no small thing.
I can't even imagine.
We worked very hard as a team to both get this right, to build the trust, and then also to keep safe as many people as we absolutely could to tell the story.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask about that because in this environment that's constantly shifting and you finding this team that you know is going to represent you well and take care of people, once that process is finished in the actual maybe physical safety, how do you kind of ensure that the people you're reporting on continue to be safe after you've put that out there? And how scary or responsible did you feel for these people that you interviewed?
So this book, you meet these women, they fought ISIS.
Yeah.
So they're not really worried about talking to me. It was much more tedious for them. You know, God, they're such a special group and I cannot wait for your listeners to meet them because this is really women who got up every morning and faced off against the men who bought and sold women. And we just don't have in our visual library the image of 25 young women in fatigues and smiley face socks and hiking boots with braids and AK-47s going in to fight the Islamic State. And I wanted so deeply to do justice to the complexity of their story, right? Because it, on the one hand, it's just this really incredible story of revenge, of justice, of women who said, no more, you know, we are going to protect our areas. And on the other hand, you know, it's just about their personal journeys. So they're young women just like you and me and all the people we know. They started as wanting to be doctors, wanting to be pharmacists, and circumstances really set them on this extraordinary path. So with them, I would say, are you willing to do the interview? And they say, oh, yeah, you know, we have so many other things to do. But yes, you know, for you, and you're the only one we're going to sit down and do all this boring, you know, 2 or 3 hour conversation with. But it was really interesting because you could see them processing too. And that happens with storytelling. All that they've seen, both incredibly inspiring and just heartbreaking things that they had seen, and just how proud they were of what they had done for their region and actually for the world, breaking ISIS.
You mentioned fighting against men, and in some cases, they were fighting against their own families to be able to fight and carve out this different path. Aside from the women that you feature in the book, how often and how frequent was that a fight that you found women actually have to have?
Oh, it was so frequent, right? My father comes from this region of the world. My father was actually born in Baghdad and his father comes from Northern Iraq. And so, you know, I talk in the prologue of The Daughters of Kobani about how this was personal to me. You know, my father one time when I was a little girl actually said to me in the middle of a big debate, said, do you really think men and women are equal?
Yes, I remember reading that and I was blown away.
And you know, and he said it from a place of love. It wasn't that he was trying to be absurd. It was in the world that he came from, that was not what he saw every day. And he loved deeply his mother, but it was not the experience he had lived. And so I understood how much they had faced from a small percentage, right, of what they'd gone through from a personal perspective, and I understood that their journey was so much greater, so much more vast than anything I had seen or experienced myself. You know, we would always exchange stories as I was working on the book about different things our family had said to us about how crazy the work we did is. And, you know, these young women did it step by step. You know, these women, many of them had wanted to be doctors or dentists. Some of them had had education taken away. Some of them, their parents had said, okay, you can do this, but no more. And then once the Civil War started, and as it became very clear that they would have to protect their own neighborhoods to keep them secure, to keep them safe, they became just ever more determined to reshape the way women's lives are lived. And I think that that started well before ISIS. But by the time ISIS arrived on the scene, there already were these women's protection units, which is the story of the Daughters of Kobani. How did these women's protection units come to be? And how did they end up leading the fight alongside the United States to stop ISIS for the world?
Yeah, and going off of that, I was really interested to learn about the notion within the group of self that Kurdish independence is so directly correlated to women's liberation. Can you talk about that and how much more you really learned about that while researching this?
I did. You know, when I was there for the first time in the summer of 2017, that's really where the book opens. And I want readers to kind of come with me and from completely, you know, new eyes to this too, so that readers understand, you know, I was on a journey alongside them. Mm-hmm. Coming to understand how this actually came to be. So there was this leader, Abdullah Öcalan, who is also the founder of the PKK, right? Who is followed by many of the people in this book, right? And they followed his teachings, which said that the Kurds could not be free until women were free. And the women in this story were very quick to talk about that. And if you look at the documents that they put into place that the book really takes readers into, they all had had these journeys where they had been up against their families. And then Öcalan's teachings, to go back to your previous question, were personal to them, right? There's was Nareen, one of our characters, who's for the first time when she's reading Öcalan and she's seeing this, as she, her parents had taken away her right to go to school, her right to marry the person she loves.
Yes.
And then she reads Abdullah Öcalan and she's having these people talk to her about how women should be equal. And it's the most radical thing she's ever read, right? Like no one in this world has ever taught her that women have equal rights. She's never heard that phrase. And actually, that comes up again and again throughout Daughters of Kobani, that most of these women have never heard the phrase women's rights or equality until they come into this world. And so the teachings of Abdullah Öcalan in this group of folks who follow him in this part of northeastern Syria, you know, his focus on women's liberation is what becomes kind of the driving force for so many of the things that happen afterward. And I hope readers will come to see him as a very complex figure, but who, you know, there was no question that the women are characters in this book. The women, you know, the people in this story are very much influenced by and motivated by.
The history that you tell of him was incredibly interesting to me. He's had such an interesting life. I wondered, when you're in Syria or any foreign place in the middle of conflict and war, how do you personally remove yourself from what you're seeing every day? Do you read books while you're there? Do you listen to podcasts? Like, if you need a break, how do you get out of your own head?
I have never been asked this question, and I really love it. I want to start by saying my responsibility is always to the people who trust me with their stories, first and foremost. And the Daughters of Kobani was such an inspiring story. And actually, they've done such a remarkable job of keeping the place feeling much more secure than anybody at home would ever imagine. I mean, truly, my husband used to say to me that your biggest threat is complacency, because it felt so very fragile, but also a fragile normalcy that these women had played a central role in bringing. And they had built this experiment in women's equality on the ashes of the ISIS fight. And every town had a woman and a male co-head. And at checkpoints, you would see women. So it almost felt like you were in Starship Troopers, or like, you know, you were in science fiction at certain times, truly. So that said, my big thing and my team, Mustafa and our drivers, because we had different drivers, you know, Hamoudi and others, would always joke with me, would be to turn on cable immediately. So I watched in Syria, I watched How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. I watched 10 Things I Hate About You. And then Max Brooks is a Friend. And I actually texted him once from Kobani because I was watching World War Z on Saudi satellite in northeastern Syria.
Oh, wow.
So I'm watching World War Z.
That's a great movie.
It is. So yes, my big thing is as much satellite TV as is possible.
I love it. Lastly, before I let you go, I would love to know if there are any books that you would recommend to our listeners that you've recently read or just love.
Oh, gosh. Yes, there are several books I would recommend. There's one called Our Women on the Ground, which was a number of women reporting on the Middle East who are from the region. Just great. It's a quick read. Your listeners will love it. I always go back to The House at Sugar Beach, which is a story from Liberia, which Helene Cooper tells just absolutely beautifully and movingly. And then, of course, reading Lolita in Tehran just is one that I go back to as one that is such a quiet story, but packs real power. And when I tell stories, I want readers to come into the world. I want readers to come into Daughters of Kobani and say, wow, I didn't see, you know, I didn't expect that. I feel inspired by that. I feel moved by that. And then I think those books do that for me.
Well, I felt all those things when reading your book. So you certainly succeeded. And it was so nice to speak to you. And thank you for taking the time and joining us.
Oh, it's great to join you. Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with Brandon Hobson.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
The Removed is the fourth novel from National Book Award finalist Brandon Hobson. The story is set in Oklahoma and centers around a Cherokee family trying to find their way forward after the murder of their 15-year-old son. The Removed explores the mythical, the spiritual, and the historical, while also weaving in themes of racism, grief, and survival. Now, here's my conversation with Brandon. Hello, Brandon. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to Late Night Lit.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on this book. I really enjoyed it so much. And I know you've published three books, right?
Yes, before this, right.
And you've been a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction. I wonder, are you used to, even after publishing three novels prior to this, are you used to seeing it at a bookstore and seeing people read it? Does it still feel surreal to have it out in the world?
It does. It still feels very surreal. The last book and the books before that were smaller press. And so the last book got some attention from the National Book Award, so that was helpful. But yeah, it's definitely odd.
I know you're also a teacher. You teach undergraduates and also at an MFA program?
Right. I do. I teach at New Mexico State and at the Institute of American Indian Arts.
Do your students ever ask you about your work, or do you ever get fans of your work in your classroom?
Some ask, not many graduate students, but for the most part, I really try to put the attention on them and not so much, not so much on me, because, you know, we're there to talk about their work. So the last thing I really want to do is talk about myself, you know, or my work. So not too much.
Throughout this story, The Removed, you write from a few different perspectives, and the lines are blurred between reality and what we see in front of us, or what you tell us we're seeing, and then the spiritual world and perhaps what the characters know or are feeling. And I wonder, did you have an easy time jumping back and forth in terms of the two during the writing process?
Not really. Nothing about writing is easy, right? It's all very difficult. I think with this book, it has multiple narrators, and they speak independently of one another. And my hope was to try to create a sort of kaleidoscope narrative that culminates into a unified revelation of separateness. And so with that structure, with those multiple narrators, it's a challenge, but it's also fun.
You talked about these different narratives, and they're mostly from the same family. Can you talk about how you wrote that? For example, Maria's story as one line that you knew was happening, or did you move from one to the next?
I wrote each thread independently, each character's thread. And so Maria, the mother, I wrote all her sections out. And then, you know, and then I think I went to Sonia, the daughter, and so forth. So I wrote them all out independently. And then the challenge was really sort of trying to put them all together, right, in a structure, which is what my editor really helped me with.
Yeah. You also explore the idea of inherited trauma as your main characters struggle with pain that they've lived through, like the death of their son or their brother in some cases, and the pain that exists for them. And maybe they're not exactly sure why or how they feel it. And so I wanted to know that idea. Did you have conversations with different people to shape that narrative and the way you built the characters? Or does it come from research or conversations you've had with people you've met or know?
I spoke to a friend of my mom's who had lost a child for Maria's sections, because I don't know what it's like to lose a child, and I hope I don't, right? You know, but I knew that to get inside Maria's head, and to try to get her voice, I needed to talk to someone. And so, you know, the question of, are you ever able to heal from such trauma? And so I talked to her mostly.
And what about for Sonia's story, for example?
Well, for Sonia's story, I had thought about someone that I know. And so her voice is very distinct to a woman that I know. And so, you know, so it wasn't as difficult. I didn't necessarily talk to or interview anybody, you know, the way that I did for Maria's sections. But I could definitely in my head hear Sonia's voice. Based on someone I know, but also, you know, she has her own sort of quirks, mm-hmm. right? So
I know you're an enrolled citizen of the Cherokee Nation Tribe of Oklahoma, and I read in a past interview that you did that some of your ancestors actually walked the Trail of Tears, which you write about in The Removed. Did you do more research into your own family history or learn about more of your ancestry as you were writing this book?
I didn't, actually. My brother has actually done a lot of research on our ancestry, but I didn't do so much before writing this book. Now, the character of Chala, mm-hmm. Who's a spirit ancestor, is actually based on a real person named Chali, T-S-A-L-I, who was killed for refusing to leave the land, right? When Andrew Jackson sent people in to remove the tribe, he refused and ended up losing his life for it. And so that story has always sort of haunted me. And so I based Chala more off that.
How did you learn about your history? Was it just through your brother's research, or were there stories that you were told as you were growing up?
We did hear stories growing up from my mom's side of the family about ancestors. But my brother has really done a really phenomenal job, you know, researching it in much greater detail, so that we have, you know, specific names that go all the way back before the Trail of Tears.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a section in the book where one of your characters describes an experience that compares to that of his ancestors. And I'd love for you to read it. And then if you could talk about the juxtaposition between the two experiences. It's page 257.
Sure. I followed the trail lined with cherry blossoms, looking ahead to the distance, listening to the sounds of owls and frogs around me. I walked down this trail and wasn't afraid. I knew I was walking west because I could see in the distance the setting sun. The sky was pink and yellow, and cherry blossoms spilled onto the trail ahead. Feathers were soon falling all around me, flooding the trail, as white as fresh winter snow. The winding trail was beautiful. I saw my ancestors ahead, but they were not crawling and wailing. They were standing. Their bodies filled the distance. I walked to them and did not grow tired. The trail before me was blazing with light. With that juxtaposition, as you mentioned, everything in this book points toward a connection with nature. And so there's a spiritual connection that not only Edgar feels, but also his sister Sonia and then his parents. They feel this connection with nature. And with that particular section that you asked me to read, is when I mentioned the trail, it's in reference to the Trail of Tears. But this is a sort of a trail out of the darkening land, this mythical place, right? And so I added a lot of colors there, you know, to sort of, it's a trail out. So everything is connected to nature and to the trail.
It's beautiful. I really loved that part so much.
Well, thank you.
Finally, I'd love to know if there are any books you would recommend to our listeners that you've recently read and loved.
Absolutely. Crooked Hallelujah by Kelly Jo Ford, and she's also an enrolled citizen of the Cherokee Nation. And Winter Counts by David Heskell Wambly Wyden is another, that's a mystery. But both of those books I read recently and just absolutely loved.
Great. Perfect. I will look forward to checking those out. Brandon, it was so nice to speak with you. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was really an honor to be here.
Our late night staff is full of avid readers, and we've asked some of them to share what they've been reading lately. Here are a couple of book recommendations from Alex and Joe.
Hi, my name is Alex Hers, and I'm the script coordinator at Late Night. I find that the books I'm most drawn to are memoirs by people whose work I look up to so much. And that's why the book I want to share with you today is called Remain in Love by Chris France, one of the founding members of one of my favorite bands, Talking Heads. The book follows Chris through many milestones of his career with Talking Heads, such as meeting David Byrne in art school, auditioning at CBGB, the taping of the historic concert film Stop Making Sense, and finally being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But above all, the thing I enjoyed most about the book was how Chris's love for his girlfriend, then bandmate, then wife, Tina Weymouth, shines through. This is the perfect book for any music lover hoping to get a peek behind the curtain. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Joe Winarski, and I am the sometimes art director for Late Night with Seth Meyers. The book I'd like to recommend is The Overstory by Richard Powers. It did win the Pulitzer Prize in 2019 for fiction, so I'm not the only person who loved this book. The book is about trees and the interconnectedness of trees and how trees have a community and an awareness of one another. In the story, the trees bring people together. And it is also about how when we separate ourselves from nature or when we destroy nature, we are ultimately bringing that destruction upon ourselves, which I think is something that is a good thing to ruminate on right now in 2021. So I recommend The Overstory by Richard Powers.
This has been Late Night Lit. My thanks to Seth Meyers, Mike Shoemaker, Gail Zamak-Lamon, Brandon Hobson, Kat Spillane, Matt Ryman, Jay Johnson, and Ross Leupold. Our theme music was written and performed by the 8G Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.